Before we begin, each time we discussed stewarding life, there's been a different topic, right? So, waiting for this to go. Oh, okay. So today we're going to look at stewarding influence. So, can everybody see now?
Yes.
Right? Good. Okay. So, stewarding influence is the capacity to have an effect on the character, development, or behavior of someone, or something, or the effect itself. Now, what was interesting is, as I was going over the topic of influence in the Bible, it's interesting because, like, the last lesson that I shared was about testimony. And through your testimony, as long as you have a good testimony, that testimony is what gives you the ability to have influence, right? And that influence is the application or what you're using and how you use your motivation to modify one's behavior. So, but as I'm wording and reading through this, I had to take a step back because everything was about the testimony. And I'm not going to give away the farm yet on who we're talking about, but I had to ask myself, how is this stewarding influence? And you might have that too, because we're going to be looking at somebody's testimony and how they kept surrendering to the Lord, even though it might not have looked like the best circumstances. But the key in this entire message is using your testimony as a way to influence others and how to gain that influence in other people's lives. So none of us really know the full extent of our influence until eternity. So we're not going to know the one thing that we said to somebody that might have changed the way they thought about this and then left them down an entirely different path. We often buy into a faulty premise that leadership and influence are related, when that's not the case. In fact, today, the key to successful leadership is influence, but not authority. So a lot of us here are parents or grandparents, and we all have authority over our children and our grandchildren. But especially with the world, that even them, the parents have authority over their kids, but a lot of the times the parents aren't what influences the children. It's going to be big tech or anybody that's going to have whatever they have in their hands, if it's an iPad or those people that they're looking at and that they idolize are the ones that are going to be influencing the children, not the parents. And some might have more of a prominent influence, like you might be a CEO of a company, you might be the president, but that doesn't mean significant. Prominent does not equal significance. The significance, it's incredible how significant it is to have a child and how significant it is to have the impact. You're shaping this child. And it's really not just parents, and really anything. Parents, who hasn't been influenced by a friend? As a friend, you actually have a direct entrance into somebody's heart that might not be accessible by that parent. And you have the power to affect the thinking, sway their beliefs, to stimulate action, and encourage direction. Teachers also have incalculable influence. Most of us, I know some of us just got out of school, some of us many moons ago got out of school, but I bet you all remember certain teachers. In fact, I think at least half would be able to name off almost every teacher from kindergarten all the way until 12th grade or however far somebody made it. And I'm going to share with you a quick story of one of my teachers. This was in second grade. Kaylee can talk about a lot of the teachers that she's had, But I struggle to remember a lot of the teachers, right? So I know they don't teach in normal school anymore cursive, but in second grade, I had a substitute teacher, and I don't remember their name, but I remember the person. And I did not like this individual. So we're going over cursive, and they had it backwards. This is just a Google image I was able to pull. So it says left-handed writer, right-handed writer. That should be switched. So, and as far as this here, how somebody should sit when writing cursive, I think the majority of us knows how to write in cursive. She really enforced this. I think she was walking around with a ruler. Or honestly, this sounds far-fetched, given how recent it was, Pastor. But it's true. But it's absolutely true. She was very strict. And you can see the angle of this paper. This angle is pretty extreme. Far more extreme than I wanted to do. And I remember I was getting so mad because every time she walked past my desk, if this is my paper, she would just turn it and then walk away. And I remember, you're kind of, bitter when you're a kid. You're like, fine, I'll show you. And then I put it sideways. I'm not kidding. I put it sideways, so my angle was very severe, right? Way double of that, what you see here. She left it like that. So she left it like that, but if I were to put it like this, where it's not perfectly like corner to corner in front of me, she would fix it. And what was interesting is she was a substitute teacher because the orientation was wrong. Here we go. So this is how it should be writing in cursive. But she was my substitute. Pretty close, right? You have to have an angle. Lefty, so I don't know if any of you have seen my handwriting. A lot of us type anymore. But I ended up having very nice handwriting, objectively. Objectively nice writing. And it was because of the substitute teacher in second grade. I've had her probably, I think it was like 2 days that week. I don't even remember why that teacher was subbing. But to her, she was just subbing a class. And to me, that person influenced my writing for the rest of my life. And it will change the way that I teach my son how to write cursive. And that just shows we think we might have an understanding of the sphere of the influence, and we don't even have a close grasp of what that is. So whether you're serving in a workplace, you're a teacher, you're a parent, everyone has influence. So this is going to be your first, should be your first fill in the blank. So everyone, parents, friends, teachers, workers, common everyday people wield the scepter of influence. I say this again because it's so important to understand. Even if you don't have kids and you have a few friends, you're always going to be teaching somebody, whether you're teaching a class here, whether you have family coming through your house. And it's important to understand that you do hold influence. And it's important that you're intentional with that influence. Now, one of the greatest threats of our usefulness for God is the myth that our lives don't have the capacity to influence or make a difference with other people. That what we do does not have an internal significance, that there's no reason to extend ourselves beyond what we're comfortable doing. You might not see the immediate effect of the influence that you have in somebody's life, and you might not perceive the impact that your life is having on others, but it's up to you to be diligent on how you're influencing your peers. So history is full of unexpected influencers, and one example of somebody that has no idea the scope of their influence is Joseph. So let's go ahead and pull up Genesis chapter 37. I'm sure a lot of us are going to be familiar with this story, but I'm going to go ahead and read in verse 1 to verse 11. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17, so this is key, he's 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. So we see favoritism. Joseph's dad favored him. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream that he told it was that his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto him, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed." So he's saying to them, "Hey, let me tell you about this dream that I had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheave arose, and also stood upright. And behold, your sheave stood around about, and made obeisance to my sheave." And his brethren said to him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us?" So let's pause here. So already these brothers don't care for Joseph too much. He's the favorite. He's the favorite where he's getting special gifts that they're not getting. And then, already not liking Joseph, Joseph comes to them and starts sharing these dreams, which is the way that God would let man know his will through dreams at this point before the Bible was completely written. So already Joseph's brethren don't care for him. He's like, "You'll never believe this. I had this dream that basically you were bowing down to me." So that's not going to be received very well. So, "Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us?" Which we see back in the first chapter of Genesis, right? Where we have dominion over the animals. And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brethren and said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." And he told it to his father and to his brethren. Now watch this. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth?" Now this is interesting here. And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. So from what I gather here, his father was like, "Okay, like I see what you're saying." His brothers were not very happy with this. So the first thing that we see with stewarding influence is when we're obtaining this influence, there's the test of persecution. So now, just so we're all on the same page, because the world likes to use different things, different words in different ways, let's look at persecution. So persecution is hostility and ill treatment, especially because of race or political or religious beliefs. So it's something like my grandparents were telling me before. When we started to not drink and not smoke, they warned us that we would lose friends, because now we're not acting like the people that we were around. And it's true. So we were losing friends because we weren't acting like the world anymore. And I know it has nothing in comparison to Calvary. It's nowhere near. But the ill treatment of you just trying to read this Bible and just trying to adapt the principles in your life, you will experience persecution by the definition. So you will be treated with hostility and you will be treated ill amongst people that you thought were your friends. So with this being a study, let's go ahead, turn towards the back of the Bible to 2 Timothy chapter 3. And I know many people based on the topic are knowing where we're going with this, but it's always good to see it again, because you don't want the familiar to become unfamiliar. So now we're in 2 Timothy chapter 3. We're going to look at verse 12. Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. It's not some. Everybody that's going to be reading this Bible, that reads God's word and adapting these things, will face persecution one way or another. Losing friends is exactly, by definition, and being treated poorly by those individuals is the definition of persecution. The next part. So, A, the revelation of the dream. So, Joseph had about two identical dreams. God gave Joseph a glimpse of his future, of the influence that he had, or has, or will have, and he was depicted as a powerful ruler, that it, and his brothers bowing before him. So, let's flip back. I hope everybody held their space in Genesis chapter 37. If not, I'll go ahead and read it. If you're there, we're looking at verse 6 through 7 and verse 9. So, here. And he said unto them, Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheave arose and stood around upright. And behold, your sheave stood around about and made obeisance to my sheaf. If I'm saying that word wrong, please correct me later on. So, anyways, Joseph was the second youngest of a shepherd family. And little did he understand that he would be soon changing the staff that he carried to be a scepter. And to think of this must have really puzzled Joseph. But he believed God's revelation to him was true. And I think that's some discernment that we get, or maybe we're feeling encouraged. We don't understand. We don't need to understand. We don't need to make sense of how something would happen. Because I don't think he would understand that a shepherd would have that level of influence, especially if you know culture, where how is the second youngest child going to have dominion over the family? That would be a series of really weird events of either a lot of sons dying, and then he would have nobody bowing down to him. So this would not make sense to him. And but it wasn't up to him. It was up for him to just understand that God will reveal this to him in time. And this is probably going to be the best rags-to-riches novel that you've ever seen. And this is showing God's sovereignty in fulfilling his promise. So, B, we have the testing of the dream. I don't know about you guys, but Joseph was born into a very dysfunctional family. So, it was full of envy, strife, and discord. He had 10 older half-brothers who were jealous of his position being dad's favorite, and especially from his revelation from God. So, as it normally was in biblical times, God revealed his will through the dreams of men. And in faith and maybe surprise, Joseph shared his dream with his brothers. It's easy to read with us being carnal, when we're reading that, it's easy to believe that he was like flaunting this dream to his brothers. When I first read it, I was thinking something along those lines, where it was, you'll never believe it. Like, you guys were all like bowing down to me, and I was pretty much this king. And that's how I read it the first time. And I'm sure a lot of you did too, where it seemed a bit odd. But I don't think that was the case with him. I really think that he was sincere, that he approached them and was just sharing this in faith to them. I don't think this was I'm better than you, even though it might seem like that. And they plotted to kill him because of this. And what's interesting is that seems like a really bad, that's really bad, right? They were plotting to kill him. But God used the desire for them to kill him only to be restrained by their greed, right? So the only reason why they didn't kill Joseph is because they realized that they could just sell him into slavery and make a profit instead of just burying him. So think about that. God used their hatred towards Joseph and their greed, so evil things, for good. Because how is Joseph going to be second in command in Egypt when he's tending sheep? It's not going to happen. So let's look at the hatred of the brothers. So there's three things. The first thing, Genesis chapter 37, verse 4 and 11, it's, "And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him." They absolutely despised him. "And when his brethren envied him," so there's the word envy, "but his father observed the saying." So the second, we're going to look at verse 19. It's ridicule. "And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh." This sarcastic, behold, he's coming, right? And the third is malice. We're going to see that in verse 20. "So come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit. And we will say, some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." I mean, think of how evil that is. Here's something that I think that would be along the same lines. So one of the most influential pastors in the 1600s spent years of his ministry in a cold prison cell. How many people know John Bunyan, right? Okay. So John Bunyan was sent to prison because he did not get permission to preach the gospel by the Church of England. So we would think that would be a pretty bad circumstances. But see, it's because of our limited understanding. John Bunyan used this time to write The Pilgrim's Progress. And The Pilgrim's Progress was a bestseller that touched the lives of millions. And he would not be able to reach that just by street preaching. In a corner, I believe he wouldn't be able to do that during those times. However, God used just the malice of men to put him in jail so that he could write that. So our ability is not, I guess, computers. You have two things that create an input. You have two inputs, and then you end up getting an output. Just because our circumstance does not, we can't comprehend how that would compute into this outcome that we believe the Lord's leading us to. That's just based on our limitations. That's not God's limitations. So Joseph's test of persecution was severe. He's a 17-year-old that was bound and carried to a former country. That would give a lot of, at 17, confusion, rejection, and pain. And the biggest danger was not him in slavery. The biggest danger was not him going into this land that he was unfamiliar with, because the biggest danger was becoming bitter. Because when you're bitter, the Lord can't use you. Because if he was just so focused on, oh, my brothers sent me to slavery, and now I'm going where I have no idea, where I'm going. At that point, when your heart becomes callous and you become bitter, the Lord cannot use you, because it's all about you, instead of looking at the circumstances that God's given you and to be able to work with what you have. See, if he failed this test and became bitter, he would have just been a slave. That's it. He would never have been a ruler in Egypt. Now, I'm going to share a story with you guys. A good friend of mine had their dad leave out of the picture about when they were 3 years old. Okay, so they had no communication with this individual. When they turned 18, they ended up having the start of a relationship with this individual. Okay, so now they were talking. And what was interesting is that time, instead of just owning up to not being by their child, it was about them still, because they got bitter. And they were so worried about those last 15 years, about what happened to them, they failed to ever develop a relationship with that child. So while they were developing this relationship, they thought, they spent all this time complaining about what they didn't get to experience. So instead of trying to make memories today that they can discuss tomorrow, they just sat there and were bitter, and that's all that it became. So, back to Joseph. From his brothers, he faced persecution. From my friend, there wasn't really any persecution there, but there was bitterness and not able to just move forward in life. And all that to say is, don't be surprised if your persecution or people that are bitter are those that should be rejoicing with you in the influence God is giving you. So the people that have the biggest capability to hurt you and persecute you are your close friends and family. And you need to be vulnerable to people, but understand that those individuals, if they're not encouraging to you, if they're not helping reinforce, like, you know, that's a good idea that you're doing this. And of course, if it's scriptural, then it would be a good idea. But those individuals would have the greatest chance to persecute you. Their envy can stir up contempt or detraction. And God has a way of turning this persecution of his people into a platform of influence. The greatest danger is not personal loss, because God can make up whatever is lost. God can turn whatever is lost into some of the greatest blessings. God can take some of the biggest hurt that you have and turn that into the biggest blessing to be able to influence other people that you have access to. When you realize that these people's hatred and ridicule toward you is a result of their envy and malice in their heart, it becomes a lot easier to not take it personal. So the second point here is the test of position. So now that you're in a specific position, how is that going to help you with your influence? So Joseph was tested by temptation. Let's look at verse chapter 39, verses 2 through 4. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him, and he made him the overseer over his house, and all that he had he put in his hand. So this is Potiphar, and he gave him everything. So, which is interesting too, because we're going to see later on that the Egyptians didn't really like Hebrew men. And Potiphar's wife took notice of Joseph and made it her mission to seduce him. So what happens now when you're in a position, you're kind of in a position of authority, of influence, and now you have temptation. Let's look at verse 12. And she caught him with him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. So just to put a picture here, so if I was trying to run away from somebody, this individual grabbed me by my clothing, and I just ran, and I didn't care what she had, like, that was attached to me, so what clothing? So he immediately ran from her. So he runs from temptation. He didn't refuse just once, but this was repeatedly. This came to a head later, and of course that's when he ran. Many can resist the first round of temptation, but Satan doesn't just tempt us once, he's persistent. So to save time, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour." James chapter 4, verse 7 says, "Resist the devil and he will flee from you." This is something that we have to understand. It's not just a one victory, it's one battle in the entire war. And let's look at chapter 39, verse 8. And he refused and said unto his master's wife, Behold, my master, wotteth not against, not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he had to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, talking about the wife, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? It's not just when you're running away from temptation, it's realizing what you're running to. And when we're running away from temptation, you are running to something, whether you recognize it or not, and it better be the Lord. Because if you're not running to the Lord, you might be just running in one trap to another trap. He kept his eye on God. And when we're succeeding and we're prosperous, so he had everything, everything that Potiphar had, he had access to. And it's easy to get, I guess, intoxicated with the prosperity of life. And we forget to have those guardrails up. And then we find ourselves worshiping the creation more than the Creator, which makes us weak and vulnerable to temptation. We need to remember who we're sinning against. So be run with identification. His focus was, how can I sin against God? Yielding to temptation is a crime specifically against God. Everyone knew that he was a Hebrew servant and that he'd never attempt to blend in with the Egyptians. He always kept his identity with the Lord. Chapter 43 in Genesis, verse 32, just shows that. Let's go ahead there. So chapter 43, verse 32. And they set on him, and they set on him by himself, and for them being themselves, so they were apart, for the Egyptians, which did eat with him by themselves, because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So even with the persecution that he felt among Egyptians, he still kept his identity with the Lord. As Christians, we need to identify with Christ. As a married man or a woman, you identify with your spouse through the ring. And I hear this weird thing that the longer you're married to somebody, the more you start looking like them. Did you guys hear that at all? It's really, what was that? Not true? Oh, that's good. Well, I would have been on the better end of that. So anyways. Right. Yeah, so I just have to deal with this, I guess. So, but in all seriousness, if we're a Bible believer, we need to identify with doctrine. If we're a Christian, our friends will reflect it. Our family, our testimonies will reflect it. Just like as a pastor, a shepherd should smell like sheep. The pastor needs to identify with the congregation. We're running short on time, but let's turn to Jeremiah chapter 9. It's always hard. So I left my Bible at home, right? Ooh. And had to pick up one of the, the Backseat Baptist collection back there. Right. Bear with me, everybody. Page 949, if anybody else is using this. All right. Chapter 9, verse 23. See, with me holding the verses back, I probably beat you all. So, all right. So verse 23, thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knowledge me. Talking about the Lord. That I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. So, our glory comes from the cross and our Savior. He gives us the strength to keep the world out of our heart and us out of worldly things. We'll speed up a bit. So, the test of problems. Problems are one of the most revealing tests of a person's character. It's easy to do the right thing when things are good, but when things are going in a difficult direction, it's hard to keep that integrity unless you already have it. A, Joseph suffered wrongfully. So even when he's getting sold into slavery, it's always safer to be in God's will, even if that means you're in slavery, than trying to do your own thing. So Joseph was aware that when he was in prison, he was not alone. He had God. God gave him favor with the jailer. Chapter 39, verse 21. So let's look at B. Joseph waited patiently. So instead of just for time, we're not going to be able to go through each of these. So he ended up going into jail, and then he's with the jailer because Potiphar then lied. And I mean, Potiphar's wife lied, and he was cast into prison. So while he was in prison, we don't know how long he was there. We know he waited patiently because it was at least 2 years, but could have been as many as 13 years. So because we don't know how long he served Potiphar, but if you take that out, we know that he was 17 when he was sold into slavery, and we know that he was 30 when he was released from prison. So he could have been waiting from 2 to 13 years. That's pretty patient. And it was for something that he never even did. He felt the glimmer of hope later on when he got to interpret a dream from Pharaoh's personal butler. But the butler forgot to remind, or so he thought. It's easy to grow bitter there because he had a glimpse of getting out of this prison. And that faded away. So whatever you do, don't compromise what you know to be right. Later on, the butler remembered and then ended up getting released from jail, which we'll go over in a second. So point four, the test of prosperity. God used the prison to bring him in contact with the butler of Pharaoh, somebody that he would have never met in the fields or never would have met at Potiphar's house. But if God released him 2 years earlier from prison, he would have been promoted from prison back to slavery. But instead, he was promoted from prison to second in command in Egypt. So he was blessed by God. Joseph's yieldness to God was evident in chapter 41, verse 38 in Genesis. We're not going to turn there. But Pharaoh recognized the presence of God in this Hebrew man's life to the point where he influenced Pharaoh to promote him to a Hebrew leader in Egypt. And then he shared his prosperity. So we see God ended up revealing to him that there was going to be famine through the land. So then for 7 years, then he's putting away food. And then eventually his brothers came to buy food because they would be starving. And not right away did Joseph reveal his identity to his brothers. He put a series of tests. But eventually, and at that point, they ended up bowing before Joseph. So that was everything coming together and just seeing God's end result here. So how did he respond to his brothers when he was wronged and had all these this pain in his life? In Genesis chapter 45, verse 3, this would be the last flip. Genesis chapter 45, verse 5. Now therefore, be not grieved. This is Joseph talking to his brothers. Be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. So he never replied with anger or malice. He replied with grace because that's what the Lord showed him. He spoke with compassion. And finally, he succeeded with forgiveness, patience, and faith. He was able to return good for evil. Through Joseph's influence and leadership, he was able to save nations from famine and reunite his family. We can pass tests that would otherwise destroy our influence with the help of the Lord. And our conclusion, influence for God is not won by struggle. It is won by faithfulness. Last part. God requires faithfulness. If you can write down 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 2. Whatever your test is, whatever you're encountering, use your influence for the glory of God. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much.